The Why Me Project, an exclusive presentation of Faith Strong Today.
Episode number
161.
That is correct.
Woo! Me, me.
Thank you for coming to practice today.
Hey, no worries.
And by the way, thank you to everyone who has sent in requests, ideas, and people that maybe we should be having a conversation with.
We've gotten some amazing suggestions, and today is one of them.
Yeah, so let us welcome our guest for this week, and Iman Gadi. How are you?
I'm excellent. Thank you so much for having me.
We like to ask the skill testing question, Iman, because we never know where it's going to go. Who are you, and where did you come from?
Wow, that's a big question. Mm-hmm. So, who am I? I mean, I'm an author. I have a best-selling memoir that I published in 2017 and then subsequently wrote and illustrated two children's books. So I love writing. I'm a certified grief recovery specialist. I'm a speaker and an empowerment coach. Those are the things I do for the world. Otherwise, I'm just a regular gal, mama, wife, and just trying to make the best of things.
All right, so you grew up, I know that you're an Edmonton gal. You grew up in Edmonton?
I did. I was born in Edmonton, and then my life has taken me all over Alberta, and I sort of, yeah, I ended up growing up, I think.
You grew up pretty quickly, if I remember correctly.
I'm a first-generation Canadian, which I'm really proud of, and my parents came from Tunisia, North Africa, and they immigrated here in the 70s. They moved to Ontario, they moved to France, had a kid, moved to Ontario, had another kid, ended up in Alberta, and had me. And then when I was 6 years old, unfortunately, my father, he murdered my mother in front of me while I was laying next to her one night. And that changed every fiber of my being. And he went to prison for a life sentence. And I was living in all these different homes from then on for the next 9 years.
Wow. What a literally life-changing moment for you.
Absolutely. It's interesting. You know, you hear the cliche saying that, you know, the silence is deafening. And I remember that moment exactly after there was a moment of silence that was actually excruciating. And I remember as a six-year-old thinking, wow, I'll never be the same.
Because, I mean, this has been so many years later. Do you like talking about it? Is it something that you'd rather not talk about?
I've made it my life's purpose to speak about it because I think what happens with people who die in a way that we're not proud of, like my mother, we end up shunning it away and not wanting to talk about it, and a lot of people get uncomfortable. And as I know very well with grief, people don't like to talk about things. It makes us really uncomfortable, which is funny because that's the one thing we're sure of in this world is that we're probably not going to last. So I've made it at first, in my early 20s before I got healing, I would say that, no, I didn't want to talk about it. In fact, I know people that I met that didn't know that about me because I would literally never share anything about myself. And it came to a point after all of the healing where I felt obligated, actually, and made it my duty to share my story so that other people with similar, you know, traumas and any kind of trauma and didn't feel ashamed anymore. I thought, you know, why should we be ashamed of things we didn't choose? We get to be happy, too.
So your mom passes beside you. Are you surprised to be alive that he didn't do the same thing to you?
Very much. Yeah, very much. And sometimes that has been a guilty feeling, and sometimes that's been a grateful feeling.
Where were your siblings when that took place?
They were sleeping. So my eldest brother woke up because he was 16 at the time, and he heard the screaming. And so he ran in and tried to fight off my father, which didn't work. And so he ran away, and he called the police, thankfully. And then my middle brother actually just didn't wake up. He's a really deep sleeper, so he didn't wake up. And, I mean, we all have our own problems arising because of how we reacted in those moments or didn't.
So at what point then, you're six, you try to deal with this as best as you can. What is the next step then that transpires? Do you don't have family in the city? You said that you'd bounced around from house to house. So my assumption now is foster homes?
That's right. So my aunt, actually my mother's sister, did live in the city and she did take us in for a little bit, and it was just too much. Three children. She was also, you know, an immigrant and didn't have a lot of skills at the time, and she had her own child, and it was just very stressful. Her sister has just been murdered, you know. It's so, while I would have loved for her to just scoop us all up and take care of us and have that happy ending, unfortunately, in her mental health at that time, that was not possible. So she and her husband, my uncle, they moved back to Africa and they left us here.
So then, I mean, that's like a second, that's like abandonment all over again.
Oh, that is a theme in my life, absolutely, is, you know, not feeling like you're worth keeping.
So you went to several different foster homes. How many did you end up going to?
Four. So including my mother's house, I lived in five homes. And I went to 10 schools in 12 years. And I was always a new girl. And I think that's why I think it helped me be a friendly, gregarious person that can talk to strangers now. So it's a skill.
Yeah, you're kind of thrust into it.
Yes, always having to be new. And that awful, awful feeling, if any of you or your listeners have ever had to be the new kid, it is just like you're standing on stage in your underwear and it's so humiliating, right? It's,
yeah.
It's like everyone's looking at me, they can see I'm different. And then growing up in a lot of, you know, Edmonton and surrounding area, a lot of people were white and I was always the kind of oddball person with the ethnic look and the curly hair and the, you know, big eyes and lips, and people just, I didn't fit in.
With the times that we're going through right now, not only in Canada, in the U.S., all over the world, we don't want to paint everybody with the same brush. And sometimes I feel like that's what we're doing in a sense. But you going through foster care, I've heard that there are great foster parents. There are terrible foster parents.
Sure.
You had four different parents, foster parents, if you will, four different homes.
Yes.
I'm guessing then you kind of, you got to experience all of that.
I did, actually, and my experience was that they're mostly horrible for me. I did luck out at the end. I feel like I call him my dad, and we joke that we adopted each other. I say I adopted him, and, you know, no one was ever really adopted, but he walked me down the aisle. He's my dad, and he was always a background figure in my life from the moment my mother passed. And so one day when I finally got to live with him when I was 15 years old, it was one of the best days of my life.
What was it like to finally have someone that you could look up to as a father?
Really heavenly. It really felt like I always, you know, wondered why my life was like that and so horribly painful. And so to finally have someone who wanted me, first of all, to be their own and out of choice, which is always so flattering. And I just felt like a princess. I really did. I remember being 15 and feeling like I think I just, like, this is my, you know, princess moment, where in all the Disney movies you wake up and you get to be happy.
Kind of going through all that phase, I know people will respond to trauma and grief in different ways. Did you ever act out, or did you cope in the opposite way?
Gosh. Yeah, I was really a stinker, you know, so I wish I was, you know, different sometimes, but I totally acted out. I think I reacted in the ways that are actually typical for someone who overcame such things. When I was 6 years old, I started going to therapy, psychotherapy, and I remember a psychiatrist saying to me, whispering to my guardians about me, saying, "It's a miracle that she speaks at all. It's a miracle." They said the trauma that this child has seen should completely shut her down and never have her be a, you know, contributing person to the world. And so I remember hearing that, and then of course you feel even worse, like, oh, I'm supposed to be a broken person.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, I will never do that. That's something that my resilience and my stubbornness and this attitude that somehow I was instilled in me or born with, I will never allow the things that I can control to be taken from me after all of the things that I can't control have definitely been taken from me. You have to find the power that you have and use it.
You talk about how at the age of 15, you finally had that father figure. Your dad did just unspeakable at the age of six. Have you ever had a relationship with him since then?
With my birth father, you mean?
Yeah.
No, I choose not to. And I did go visit him in prison in my mid-20s to get, you know, answers that I never got. But I got other answers. So sometimes we go looking for apologies. And I think that's something that was really powerful in my life, is that I was looking for an apology of sorts, which sounds really silly at this time looking back. But when I was 24, 25, I thought, you know, when you're so angry at someone and you spend your whole life being afraid of them and they have yielded so much power over you, you think, you know, you owe me this thing. You owe me, you know, you need to beg for forgiveness. I know a lot of people that I work with, clients and things, have felt that way when they've been wronged. Like, you owe me an apology. And as though an apology could ever, ever do anything to redeem himself, right? So I went to the prison several times to basically yell at him and demand this apology. And it never worked out that way, because to this day he pleads innocent and has not ever admitted that he murdered my mother. So it's pretty hard to get any justice from a person who is living in another land in their mind.
Well, how did you get from that girl that was fighting for, you know, your own sense of empowerment to the woman that you are today? Because something had to have happened.
I really realized that no one was coming for me. It's the loneliest feeling in the world, but it's also a place where you can pivot and take control of what you can. And I think a lot of people who are victims of violence, you know, I grew up very violent. I lived in these homes that were very abusive. I was beaten, sexually assaulted, and starved, like really, really horrific things. No one's coming for you. And it's so sad. It's like, no one's going to do this thing that you think you deserve, which is to be happy. And then you think, well, that's not fair. How come other people get to be happy? I've seen it. I've read about it. I want it too. And I thought, I remember one day just being like, man, if you do not get up and do this for yourself, if you do not gather whatever strength you have in your body and fight, no one is inviting you to the happiness table. No one. And if you do not get up, you will never get there. And it's like the saddest feeling in the world, but also a place where you become willing to do what it takes. And I remember thinking that, like, what would you do? And I said to, like, I remember like crying on the floor and looking up and being like, please, I will do anything. And that was kind of the moment where I woke up the next day and I just sort of wiped my tears and I was like, okay, so here we go. What does anything look like? And it was, for me, an intense amount of therapy, a lot of coaching, a lot of making different decisions, a lot of learning self-esteem, a lot of exercising and punching bags and getting that anger out. I mean, I became like really into kickboxing, and that was quite therapeutic for anyone who wants to healthily punch something out. And so I continue this journey.
Did you feel broken? Did you feel like you needed to be fixed?
Yes, always. That's why I called my book that.
That's fair.
Yeah, because like I know that I believe no one is ever broken. I really believe that. I don't think it's a possibility while you're alive. Broken people don't live. I called my book Cracked Open, Never Broken, because all those times that I thought, why is this, what in the heck, you know, is happening to me? I thought I was broken. I thought there was something fundamentally wrong with me. You know, I just have bad luck. Like, this is not good. I must be cursed. And at the end of things, when I could look back at the healing process, I thought, no. You know, there's that beautiful quote that the cracks are where the light goes in. And that's what I thought. I was like, you're like an egg that's just being cracked open. And you just, that's how you are born again and again and again.
And that's why I was asking that. Is that part of the reason why you decided to write the book? Or what was the reason behind it?
So the reason behind writing the book, which was very difficult for me. I had never really shared my story with anyone. Like I said earlier, there were people who knew me that didn't know those things. I wanted to help other people to heal. I knew that my mission was, why would I have all these tools in my toolbox? Why would I have all these mountains that I know how to climb if it would be so selfish for me not to help other people over the top? And so I thought to myself, the scariest thing on earth would be if they knew about me. Like, that would be the most vulnerable gift that I could give to someone, to say that you're not alone. You can't just tell people they're not alone. You have to show them, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh my gosh, if they're going to know how human I am and how broken down my life was, and that might be the only way that they feel seen. And is that a gift I can give to them? Yes. Is that a gift that will help them? Yes. Is that my calling? I believe so. So there, I must bear all. And so I thought, okay, no one's going to trust me the way I want them to if I don't trust them to hold me.
What were people's reactions to your book, especially for the people that you knew?
Oh, well, nobody wants to be in your memoir. Okay, I'll let everyone know that if you're thinking of writing a memoir, unless they have a really amazing part, they do not want to be in your memoir. So I made some friends from it, but I also upset very many people, even though I was as respectful as possible. I let people, everyone who had a major part, I let them read it. I let them read it first before it was published. I let them, I interviewed them. I changed their names. I allowed them to change anything that they felt would be, you know, too much for them to have published. I absolutely was as respectful as possible with maintaining the integrity of my story. At the end of the day, I realized that just because I went through all the healing so I could write the book, it doesn't mean that people who are in it or read it will also feel that healing, and that I can't control the reactions of other people. I upset people.
Because here's this book that's probably really helping others, but yet the people in the story might not be where you are, their healing journey.
The thing about that is I respect that so much, but for victims of violence, we're the ones who always have to hold the secret. And it's a lot of pressure. It takes a lot of my mental health to hold all these secrets in, and I don't want to.
You might not be able to answer this. It was you who was going through this, but you also had two brothers. How are they doing? I mean, you're on this road to recovery. You have done a complete 180. Are they in the same stage? Are they at the same steps that you are?
No.
How difficult is that then?
It's extremely difficult. It's really hard to be the healer, the one who wants to heal, and everyone else, nobody wants to talk about it. It's the elephant in the room. I just don't understand why people don't want to talk about it. I mean, I understand because I was that person too, but when you're on the other side of the healing, you realize, oh my gosh, it's so much better over here, guys. It feels so like light and airy and helpful. Why don't you want to do it? And then you have to respect people's journey. And it's really hard for me to do that. I do it, but it's very hard. I want to shake them and be like, this is where the glory is. This is the great part over here. But then you have to just say, you know, we're all autonomous. I respect you and your journey. And if this is something you never want to speak about again, which is their prerogative, then I respect you.
And we are human, and we crave relationship. We're not supposed to be alone. Here you are going through, I mean, different foster homes, losing of, essentially both parents, but then gaining. It's such a unique dichotomy of your life. But then when it comes to you and getting married and you and dating, how was that then for you?
Oh, my goodness. I did the long road, as I always do. I have to say, that's why I like to guide other people, because I'm like, you guys, I take the longest route possible to do things. Like, I will absolutely stop at every pit stop and every lesson that the world wants to teach me. And so that's why I feel dutiful to help other people, because I'm like, okay, no, don't stop there, y'all. I stayed there for 2 years. Don't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
Take
like,
the shortcut.
Don't. Yeah, like, seriously, like, come over here. I built a path. It's easier. So dating, I mean, I had no ability to connect with other people. I was the perpetual serial dater woman that could not connect. I would date someone for a year and they'd be like, I love you. And I was like, oh, really? Oh,
that's neat.
Okay. Yeah. Like what is, I'm not feeling you, man. So, I don't know how to do that. Like, it just was like, there was this protection that I didn't realize I was wearing, this armor that I was just this, I guess, subconscious decision that I was never going to let anyone through. So it took me a long time to actually be able to do those things that, you know, I wanted to do, but they were just so vulnerable. But so, I mean, I didn't get married till 35 years old.
What was it about your now husband that made you decide the armor needs to come off?
I've never met anyone that truly lived unconditional love before. You know, I remember when I met him and I said, I don't believe in unconditional love. That's ridiculous. People always have conditions. And he went, oh, that's so sad. And I kind of felt embarrassed, you know, because his reaction was like, oh, my poor dear.
Yeah.
And I thought, what do you mean? You believe in unconditional love? And he was like, absolutely. And he's proven it. He lives that way. His family's like that. And he was raised that way. And he's the kindest souled person I have ever met.
And how many children do you have now?
One
child.
Yes, she's 2.5.
Aww.
Yeah, it's fun age.
Yeah.
She's hilarious.
How has having a child change now your perception of things?
I come to her with a place of knowing what it's like not to have the things she has. And so I have a deep appreciation for the moments that we spend together. I get to kind of be a kid too, which makes me heal a little bit more and also makes me sad a little bit too. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting process because grief is never ending when you have experienced it. And so there are moments where I'm filled with joy and pride that this little being came to me and trusts me to be her mother. And then I'm sad that, you know, there are people who don't have that, right?
there are ways that we're able to give back. There are ways that we are able to do something to be able to help out. And I mean, through grief recovery, that's one thing that you do. But there's also other ways. What's the Lunch Bags of Love?
Oh, my goodness. The Lunch Bags of Love is a cool little project I started in 2013. Someone told me that this, they said, when you feel helpless, help somebody else. And I was sitting in my apartment, and I thought, I want to help somebody, but I don't know how. And food for me is love. I love to feed people. It is something that just means so much to me. My mama cooked all the time. I love cooking. You can always find food at my house. So I thought, I want to go love up on people who maybe don't get a lot of that. And so I made a few lunch bags, and I put some of my favorite quotes in there, maybe, you know, to inspire something in someone else and to let them know they weren't alone. And I went downtown with my backpack with a bunch of lunch bags, and I called them Lunch Bags of Love, and I handed them out to our brothers and sisters that live on the streets. And it was the coolest project because people would want me to read the quotes to them. They didn't understand Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And if you're sitting on the street with someone who has his or her own problems that got them to the street, you know, and they're asking me what Shakespeare quote means. And I don't know, it was just so touching. And so I started that, and all of a sudden all these other people wanted to do it too. And for me, it's a project anyone can do. I do not own it. It is the idea of sharing what you can with people who could sure use the company and maybe a meal.
How important is it for someone to be able to give back and to do things like that?
I honestly think that's what makes us feel human. To be honest, I really do. I think that if you get to a place where you have something, that nothing feels better than having it except for giving it away.
Mm-hmm.
Like I always wanted to feel seen and heard and loved and cared about, right? And that's what I want all my clients to feel. That's what I want everyone in my audience. Every time I'm like, I see you. Thank you for being here. You could have been anywhere else, and you're here with me. And I want to give you everything. I tell everyone every time I show up, I'm like, I'm going to give everything I have to you. I'm going to go home and have to take a nap, okay, guys? Like, I'm going to be dead after this. Like, take from me what you can. Ask me every question and just take action. Take what you can and then do something about it.
Grief is such a journey, and it changes in different ways for the different phases of life that you're in. But I've noticed, maybe it's a North American thing, but I just feel like we don't really grieve well as a culture. No. Why do you think that is?
It's uncomfortable. People don't want to be uncomfortable, and they don't have the answers. Everyone wants to have an answer. You notice when, you know, people go to a funeral, they all say the same thing. I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm so sorry, right? Mm-hmm. Is there anything I can do? They ask the griever for the work, right? Is there anything I can do? I don't know, man. I'm pretty suffering. I'm suffering right now. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if I don't have tasks for you right now, but if you brought a casserole, I'd probably take it. If you came and mowed my lawn, I'd probably be grateful. If you shoveled my walks or walked my dog or hung out with my kids so I could cry in the bathroom by myself, that'd probably be helpful. I don't have the ideas, but we as the healed people, the people that are not in that same state, need to be the ones who do the work. And we're always asking the people who are already under extreme stress to do the work.
You just come up with a great idea. We at funerals now give out a grief checklist. So when somebody says, hey, is there something I can do? You hand them a checklist. Well, on there is a casserole. On there is mow the lawn.
Yeah.
On there is be a shoulder to cry on. I don't know.
Yeah.
Do something rather than just say, hey, thoughts and prayers, thinking of you. Let me know if there's something that I can do.
Yeah.
Yes. And something I teach to people who are, you know, take my grief recovery programs, and sometimes people bring me in to give talks at businesses that have lost someone, you know, and I say, they go, well, I don't know what else to say except for I'm sorry. And I said, okay, how about, wow, this is awful. And they're like, well, I'm like, well, just acknowledge that it's excruciating. This must be excruciating. I can't imagine how you feel. This is beyond my comprehension. I am so uncomfortable right now. I can't imagine how you feel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you say things that are the truth. And then you ask about the person who passed. And this is the thing that I wish everyone did. We're all so afraid. We tiptoe around someone's lost baby. We tiptoe around, you know, your husband, you know, the widows and widowers, right? We tiptoe around them instead of saying, oh, man, remember that time? And he did that thing, and it was hilarious. And they laugh. If you ever do this to a griever, it is the best feeling in the world. You say something about the person they're grieving, and they smile. And that's how we keep people alive. They live through our memories. They live through our conversations, through our books, through our writings. they live through our songs. Anything you can do about these to make these people still stay with us, they that's what helps.
Well, looking back throughout your life, I'm sure you've had one or two of these, those why me moments.
Yeah. I can't imagine that you would have one. I just don't.
Yeah, right? Yeah, the why me moments. I remember as a kid, that was sort of probably my theme song in my head. I was like, why me? Oh my gosh, why is this happening? And I just, you know, people say things happen for a reason, and it always upset me. I find it a little bit of a bypassing statement that excuses a lot of bad behavior. I don't think that my mom was killed for a reason that I could evolve from. But what I did decide when I asked myself why me as a child repeatedly was I said to myself, I don't have the answer. So you know what? I'm going to make a reason. I'm going to make a reason. I'm going to be a glorious story. I want people to look and say, wow, wow. I cannot believe this woman has risen from that. I cannot believe that. And if she can do it, maybe, you know, maybe I have something in me too. Because she didn't have a lot of reasons to stand up. And you can live in the why me moment for the rest of your life because it's a pitiful moment to think that. You're asking from a place of sadness and victimhood of, you know, poor me, why me? And instead I thought, I'll tell you why.
Yeah. I'll give you a reason.
Let me show you why. Because I can hold these heavy things, and I will spend the rest of my life showing other people how to be strong and how to build the muscles to hold heavy things that they are given and to be proud of those things.
I can't imagine, but I'm glad that you've been able to share your story today. Cracked Open, Never Broken, which is available at Iman Gatti, I-M-A-N-G-A-T-T-I, for those who thought there might be a silent Q or a hyphenated Z. But Iman, appreciate you for taking some time and sharing your heart.
Thank you so much for having me. What a pleasure.
Thank you to everyone who has listened. Thank you to everyone for their suggestions, because we will continue to strive to, whether it's a hot topic issue or something that just somebody wants to learn about.
Yeah, we'll dive into those as best as we can.
Yeah, really appreciate the fact that you send us messages on Instagram or on the Twitter. You can email whymeproject@outlook.com. And then when it comes to downloading, there's a bunch of places you could check out.
Yeah, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts, you can find Why Me Project podcast. And you can always head to faithstrongtoday.com for more.